Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know.
I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Rose, he's done well, he's found a cross, Adam Lallana, it's in! Relief!
The process changes, but it never stops. From the moment you walk into an academy or have that first trial and know you want to do whatever it takes to become a professional footballer, to the point of being a Champions League and Premier League winner, your decisions are conditioned by the game. What you eat, how you sleep, the lessons you learn. Football is more relentless than ever, and reaching the elite level, as our previous guests on Between the Lines have discussed, is becoming ever more challenging.
I think it's important that people need to realise that we do have bad days at the office. That will happen. You know, we don't want it to happen, but it does happen. We try for it not to happen. Believe me, we work day in, day out. Being at Brighton as well, the past 3-4 months has taught me as well is that how hard it is getting a Premier League win. I probably took that for granted being at Liverpool.
To walk us through his journey is a player Jurgen Klopp called one of the most influential on setting standards he has ever worked with.
I miss already everything about him.
Maurizio Pochettino labelled him special, unique, saying there is no other footballer in the country like him in terms of technique, tactical intelligence and training application. Gareth Southgate viewed him as England's most effective link player for the longest time.
All I wanted to do was play football, I don't think I ever really felt that the pressure really at that age that I was going to make it, because I was always kind of ahead of the curve. So deep down, I think I kind of always knew I had the fundamental attributes to become a professional footballer.
Adam Lallana Lana takes us between the lines, detailing the setbacks that go along with these kind of compliments, shedding light on his preteen days at an academy, growing into what his teammates term a training machine, all the way through to morphing into a guiding light for youngsters in recent years.
So kind of it got to a stage where like I didn't really want to wait, didn't really like want to leave to go to training really, and I therefore had no energy because obviously wasn't eating as much, so then kind of didn't have the right energy to train. And then it's just you're in, it's a snowball effect, isn't it? If you don't, if you're not eating well enough, then the risk of injury is obviously higher. I need to score a goal ASAP because my eldest gives me such stick because I'm just not scoring. I could be playing left back or right back. You've not scored today. Why not? Are you going to shoot?
Adam was kind enough to share his time with us after training at Brighton, as well as when he got home to have dinner with his family and continue trying to house train his new puppy. So let's take it from the top. Life at an academy and how pronounced the pressure already is at that early stage.
When I moved to Southampton when I was 12, I definitely recognised that it went up a level there. Maybe one of the reasons was it was more travelling. It was like 40 minutes in a car and I had to go there two or three evenings a week after school, which was obviously a big commitment for my family. You know, my dad or my mum who would have to take me there. And just the level of pressure was definitely increased from what it was like at Bournemouth. So it probably wasn't until I was 12 years old, really, it kind of started to get a bit more serious, if that makes sense.
At the age of 12 then, was it apparent, the competition in the academy at that stage already? Did you look around and think that there might be kids that are better than you or that you're definitely better than some of them?
It was very apparent because at that age we had one age group and then we were in, they put us in three groups. So you had an A group that would play every week and then you had a B and a C group that would like alternate different weekends. So the A group got to play every week and then the B and C group had a game only every other week. So it was, you know, it was staring you in the face, really, which looking back is quite remarkable, really, I think, especially at that age, because I remember when I signed for Southampton at 12, I went straight into the A group. But, you know, being in group B or C, I just think it's just not the right thing to do looking back for kids at the age of 12. They don't want to be feeling that competition or that level of competition.
Almost like they're not good enough already at that age.
Exactly. It's too young. They're too young. Way too young. Yeah, at that age, you still need to be, you know, you're either at the academy or you're not, I think. And you're either together in one group, one age group, or you know, you're not at that level yet and you're still playing grassroots. But to kind of divide it up, I think, is a little bit too much, I think. And looking back, you know, probably was difficult for the people being in, that are in B or C group, I think.
One of the other things when you're that young and in an academy setup is obviously the different levels of growth for everyone, both, you know, physically and in terms of technical ability and stuff. Is that something you struggled with?
Yeah, maybe at little different points in growing up, going through the age groups. I mean, you know, my eldest boy is eight and he plays at the Bournemouth Academy at the moment. And it's amazing because I'm almost like, I feel like I'm like reliving my youth, say my youth career, my younger years when you start playing football. And you know, there are just there are a lot of similarities. You know, you see the kids that are physically far more developed at that age. Then you see the kids that are technically more developed, that are stronger and quicker or better with their feet. And you can't really start judging kids at the age of 8, 9, 10, 11. I mean, until kind of everyone's physically developed all their attributes, you can't, it's too difficult to start judging kids, I think, anyway. And that's why I liked it that when the under-23s came in instead of the reserves, because I just thought when they brought that in to the structure of the youth development program, I just think it gives them kids that are later developing an extra 2-3 years to naturally develop. So I remember being in the youth team and, you know, you're very, very close to your mates in your age group, but you're really, really competing with them day in, day out. And at times it would get feisty or there'd be arguments because you're living in each other's pockets basically day in, day out. And although you're a team, you know, trying to win your matches at the weekend, you're in direct competition with your teammates for a professional contract. It's as simple as that. And that is a lot of pressure at such a young age, I think. You know, my youth career, I wasn't one of the ones that were physically strong enough, or I didn't develop fully until probably I was 20, 21, even maybe 22. So it definitely took me an extra couple of years to fully develop. I wasn't one of them that were blessed with pace or power or strength at the age of 15, 16. So that's you know, one of the big things I took out of youth team football, and even looking back on it now.
Adam's back at his house now, and I wanted to understand more about his personal struggle with ulcerative colitis. It's a chronic bowel disease that former Manchester United midfielder Darren Fletcher had a severe strand of, and even needed to be hospitalised over several times before undergoing surgery. Here's Adam's experience with the condition.
I can't remember if I was 18, 19, but I was definitely maybe in like my second year of scholarship or third year, and there was definitely time. So I remember I was still living with my mum and dad at their house, and used to get the train to Southampton from Bournemouth to train in. And I just remember kind of it got to the stage where like I just didn't really want to leave the house because there was like a circumstance, there was situations where obviously you needed to go to the toilet, and you know, you just worry that you're gonna get caught where you don't know where one is. Or and then I started obviously like figuring out the pattern. It's whenever I ate, which was obviously when I needed to go to the toilet, and I used to get the horrendous griping belly aches, which are the symptoms of ulcerative colitis. So kind of it got to a stage where like I didn't really want to wait, didn't really like want to leave to go to training really, and I therefore had no energy because obviously wasn't eating as much. So then kind of didn't have the right energy to train, and then it's just it's a snowball effect, isn't it? If you're not eating well enough, then the risk of injury is obviously higher, and you know, your immune system suffers and all the rest of it really. And I suppose that there's them similar factors have been the case to a lesser degree, because it's been under more control, I suppose, throughout my career at certain stages. So yeah, it's a challenging condition, and I think I'm lucky because I think I've got a relatively mild version of ulcerative colitis. There's people that have had to have parts of their bowels removed because of it, and so on. It'd be interesting to kind of see what my like mum and dad's views are. I definitely remember with the symptoms I was facing, my dad was really worried it would be something worse than ulcerative colitis, whereas I definitely didn't treat it with the right respect initially when I was diagnosed. You know, I remember I got put on a course of medication and it cleared up relatively straight away. And then, you know, I'm not sure if I mentioned to you before that I wasn't very good at taking my tablets on time. I think I had to take them 2-3 times a day, maybe in the morning, maybe at lunchtime in the evening. I was missing times of the day when I should take it, and then I'd go back into relapse, and the symptoms would come start up again. So you know, as I say, I was 18, 19. All I wanted to do was play football, you know. I didn't really, I don't think I ever really felt the pressure really at that age that I was going to make it, because I was always kind of ahead of the curve. So deep down, I think I kind of always knew I had the fundamental attributes to become a professional footballer. It was just about, you know, keep working hard and do what you think is right and keep learning, improving, and then it will come. So I don't really remember kind of there being any big pressures. But obviously, schools I had in front of me was obviously ulcerative colitis, suffering with I had a regular heartbeat as well when I was younger. So that was just before I got diagnosed with ulcerative colitis. So that was more concerning than whether I was going to make it eventually. I always kind of had that feeling, that inner confidence that I was going to. I was very lucky because, you know, I had very great support from home. I had a stable family. My dad was, you know, that I always look back and my mum and dad were absolutely perfect with me in terms of never ever putting any pressure on me, even to go to training. You know, my schoolwork was always more important, and until I maybe got to a certain age where I actually was able to drop a couple of subjects from school to go into the academy one day a week. It's called day release. It's, I think, my age group was the first year that happened, maybe 15 odd years ago now.
So Rovers in front just seconds after the break, and with unrest spreading among the Southampton supporters, Doncaster capitalised again. Another helpful deflection from Jan Poole's size, though Coppinger was keen to claim that goal for himself. Saints fans turned their fury on chairman Rupert Lowe, and Marek Saganowski's goal in stoppage time made no difference. A stormy end of a season brewing.
We got relegated from the Championship down to League One in probably my first full season when I was 21. And that was a little bit of a reality check, I think, not just for myself, but for a lot of people associated at Southampton. And I think that needed to happen. So I think getting relegated into League One was probably the best thing that could have happened for, you know, not just myself, but the club. And that was when we had like financial problems and we didn't get paid on time. We went into administration, and then Alan Pardew came in when we had minus 15 points, and he was a proper manager. Do you know what I mean? A proper, well-known, it was a massive, massive signing or employment for Southampton at the time. And it just gave us good structure, and he was absolutely brilliant with me. And, you know, taught me a lot. You know, it was the first full season I kind of had under him. And, you know, looking back now, I can't believe how kind of unprofessional I was really at that. And looking back to how it is now, I know it was probably a different era, say, even 12, 13 years ago. And that there's so much I would do differently in terms of just looking after myself. But, you know, at the time, I thought I was probably doing things right. And it was, as I said, it was a different era. And, you know, and the change room I was in was different to what I'm used to now. So I think you always look back and think you can do things differently.
On that point, do you find that kids coming through now, like the teenagers coming through, do they have it easier because the advances in nutrition and sports science and all that stuff is, you know, the information is so readily available and clubs have adapted so much and grown so much that they have that support? Or do you actually feel maybe there's more pressure on them now because of all these advances, because they have to be, you know, 100% professional all the time, and with the social media exposure? When you were coming through, you didn't have to deal with this, with the social media exposure. So do you think it's a double-edged sword for them, sort of?
Yeah, I think a bit of both. I think they've got it easier in terms that they have everything laid out to them on a plate, the facilities, the coaching, the access to knowledge. Is you know, is at such a high level now, but I do think there's more pressure on them because of the social medias. You know, they've, you know, pressures that they've got to be doing this or doing that or have this and have that, or and that's, you know, it's an age thing. It's we're living in 2020 now. It's where the world's at, and I think well, when I was younger, it was different. You know, there wasn't social medias. There might be, obviously there were camera phones and whatnot, but you weren't getting videoed or filmed. Which feels like now 24/7. So kids have got to kind of grow up nowadays so much quicker. You know, they've got to be, they're 17, 18 year olds, but they're acting like probably what I was acting when I was like 25, 26. And you've got to grow up really, really quickly. And that's very, very evident. But it's also a good thing, I think, because it, you know, it gets them, it gives them a better chance of sustaining a better career at a higher level for a longer period of time.
I know you are quite involved and invested in youngsters. You were at Liverpool. I know it's the same at Brighton. You do, you know, try and guide them. Given the world that we're living in now and what we've just spoken about, what has been the main sort of tips or advice you try to give them?
You know, you say I'm invested in young lads. I don't see it as my job or anything like that. It's just something that I quite enjoy doing, because I think it's come from when I was a young lad growing up at Southampton. There were three or four players that stick to mind that, you know, took their time and went out of their way to, you know, in training, whether it was give me a couple of tips or just kind of a bit of praise that they would give me, or they'd pull me up and say I should do something slightly different. And, you know, something so little, what I felt like at the time them doing to me meant so much and went a long way to giving me a little bit more confidence, or just helping me and making me feel kind of at home playing or training with the first team. So I don't know, for example, last year or a couple of years ago, when might have only been last season, when Nico Williams trained for one of the first times with Liverpool, you know, I just kind of went out, you know, made sure I asked him what his name was, because I didn't know his name. You know, I'm just picking this, just picking Nico, just because he's just come into my head. He wore Puma boots as well, and I was, you know, one of the only other Liverpool players that wore Puma. So, you know, I just made a little comment like, does he like the boots, etc. And just a little comment like that, I know for a fact, can make him feel, not $1 million, but just put him at ease and make, because it's a big thing, you know, training with the first team for your first time, and especially at Liverpool. So I just try to just go out of my, it's not even going out of your way, just doing something to maybe make the young lads feel a little bit at ease, because it can be daunting, you know, going into an environment, into a training session where you don't know many people's names. You know, we've all been there, like your first day at school and someone coming up to you and making a fuss at you and being nice to you. It makes you feel good and a bit more relaxed.
You mentioned Nico there, which is a good example because he is still so young, coming into an environment where he's not just at an elite team. He's at a team with ambitions of retaining a Premier League title and also, you know, regaining a European crown. And then there's all these pressures. I'm not sure if you've seen, but he's had a lot of abuse on social media. And for someone that is so young coming into that environment, it's quite difficult. You, I'm sure, as you've evolved during your career, you've gotten better at shutting out the external noise. But for somebody like him, it will be quite difficult.
Yeah, I mean, it's just coincidental that I mentioned Nico a couple of seconds ago and you've brought that up, because I actually remember watching the Liverpool game, and I came across it on my socials That he took a bit of stick for me. He might have deleted his Twitter or his social media. And it was, you know, if that's what, you know, a young lad's had to do because of it. I remember it was such ridiculous scrutiny or opinions of these keyboard warriors. I mean, I remember watching the game and the lad didn't even have a bad game. I mean, I can't remember who they were playing against, but I remember watching it and, you know, he might have given the odd pass away or, but it's, you know, he's a young lad, he's learning. Of course you're going to have bad games, you know, and for, you know, to see a young lad kind of playing at the top level for a top team, kind of having to feel like he has to kind of deactivate his socials or whatever, it's sad, isn't it, at the end of the day. But he had to go through it, you know. It would have built a thicker layer of skin for himself. He would have it would make him stronger, because he's going to have bad games in the future, and he'll know just to build up that thick skin, and you just ignore it and make sure you kind of don't give it the access or the attention it deserves, because he's a top player, and he's already shown that so far in what he's achieved in such a small period at Liverpool, you know. And as I said, I think he trained with us for the first time last season, so he kind of hadn't been training with us for like 2-3 years. For example, like, you know, Curtis Jones, you kind of seen him. Used to come up every now and again. I remember Nico just coming out of the blue, was like, well, I've not seen Nico before. And then training with him, been like, oh, who's this lad? Where's he been? It was almost like one of them, like, where's he been? Because of, you know, he's that good and I've not seen him about. I think maybe a week or so later, he might have got his first goal for Wales, wasn't he? I was absolutely made up for him, because obviously I was aware of that he had a, you know, one average game, and apparently all the keyboard warriors are out, and, you know, he's a young boy still, so he's not going to be used to reading things like that. So as I say, it's the world we live in nowadays, and he'll be stronger for it. I have no doubt about that.
Are you relieved in a sense that when you were finding your feet, there wasn't social media around where your every mistake wasn't scrutinized by millions globally, who then instantly could comment and try and cut you down to size? Because it is actually quite a difficult thing to juggle when you're at that age.
No, definitely. I mean, I worry for my kids. I mean, when I worry for the day when my kids are going to be like, you know, I want an Instagram account. It's like, I don't know where I'm going to start. And that's even just in normal day life. I mean, God knows what I'd do if one of them's, you know, a sports person or plays football or cricket or whatever. And because, you know, it must be so tough for a young lad, and pressures on young kids nowadays, young girls or whatever. I mean, I don't know, we could speak about debates about it, couldn't we, the pros and cons about it for all night. Yeah, but I do agree. I think I was lucky that when I was coming through, there wasn't socials, because that would just be added pressure times 10.
You speak there about being, you know, worried for your lads who are obviously, they want to get into football, are trying the whole academy setup and stuff. How are you as a football dad? Are you, because obviously they're looking to you for guidance and advice because you are who you are, but at the same time, I'm sure you're so conscious of not putting pressure and stuff on them.
Yeah, well, I need to score a goal ASAP, because my eldest gives me such stick because I'm just not scoring. I could be playing left back or right back. You've not scored today. Why not? Are you going to shoot? It is funny, but as a football dad, I think I'm relatively good. I mean, I just try to kind of take a leaf out of my dad's footsteps, really, and how he was with me, which was, you know, very, very quiet on the sideline when he was watching me or when I'm watching my lad. You know, tell him well done, and did you enjoy it at the end of the day? Just trying to keep the pressures off them, because the pressures, there's so much pressure that comes later on in the development or whatever. I think it's just important that they just enjoy it as much as possible. Because my fondest memories of being a kid was my grassroots footy, and I think that's taken away from the kids so early nowadays, because the academies, you know, they have matches on the same days, and it kind of takes preference ahead of grassroots, which is a bit sad, really, because they're the best days. Even my lad plays for a grassroots team. I can tell straight away he enjoys that the most. There's no pressures. He's playing with his mates, some mates from school and his team. All right, different levels, but he's just enjoying it and playing with his mates. Nothing serious. And it just becomes serious so quickly. And with that comes pressures.
We've heard from Adam about critique from his son, but what was it like working with some of the most celebrated managers in the Premier League? We find out after the break.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember. Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Anna Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
This week on Stakhanov.
One Direction's Liam Payne was in the studio talking to Jack Mate's Happy Hour about life as a global pop star, with untold stories about his time on The X Factor, life in the world's biggest boy band, and going solo. This one is not to miss.
I was part of this massive machine, and I knew my part in the machine very well. So I knew what I was doing every day. But then when that machine falls away and you're in the world and the world's just happening around, like, where do you fit?
You can catch the full episode on Spotify. If that doesn't tickle your fancy, on this week's Football Ramble Presents, Kate and Jim sat down with former Chelsea, Juventus and England striker and football legend Enya Luko to discuss her storied career and her autobiography, They Don't Teach This.
Whether it's racism, whether it's bullying, whether it's sexism, often these behaviours are silent. They're not always something that's said. It's a feeling, it's a set of behaviours by a group of people towards you that makes you feel incredibly isolated.
You can hear more from Enya Luko with Football Ramble Presents on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All that and more at Stakhanov.
You speak there about pressures, and when you were out at Southampton and you became captain, you sort of had the weight of the world on your shoulders. There was so much responsibility on you, but the chairman was also calling you all the time to find out what was happening. So you had your role as a footballer, you had your role as a captain, so making sure the rest of the squad were trying to, you know, perform to their optimum, making sure everyone's taken care of on the pitch. And then you've also got the chairman calling you up to discuss matters with you. And I know Maurizio Pochettino came in and made all of that stop. I know you two have a very special relationship, and I want to find out from you, apart from just ridding you of all that extra sort of stress that you didn't need, what else did he teach you that you will impart going forward?
Corey, he taught me a lot. I was lucky enough to work with Maurizio for a year and a half. As I said, apart from when he, you know, it was, you know, 2-hour conversation that we had, he found, and it just, which we spoke about everything, family, this, that, the other, and it came up in conversation that the chairman was calling me, and he just knew instantly that was like the reason I wasn't playing as probably well as I could, because it was just added pressures. I was, you know, I was basically just trying too hard. But I think just, you know, Maurizio also taught me just a lot about values, not just in football, but to have in life, really. You know, he would get to work at kind of 7 in the morning, and he'd be leaving at like 5-6 in the evening, and they'd be in the office all day with the YouTube. He'd just have music on YouTube playing, and the scented smells going, and he'd call lots of players in at different times just for chats, and how just ask you about your family. He just kind of invested so much into you as a human, as a person. And I think that's maybe why also, you know, I feel like I quite like, I don't want to say mentoring young players, but just like helping younger players, or and making sure they're okay, because again, Maurizio showed that just by speaking and showing that he cared for not just the footballer, me the footballer, but me the person, and my home life and how my kids are. You know, I remember signing my contract. I think Maurizio had only been there a couple of months. And I signed a new contract that the chairman had kind of sorted and okayed and sanctioned or whatever. And we all went for a meal to kind of celebrate. And I say we all, it was the chairman, Maurizio, Jesus, Tony, and Miggy, and my mum and dad and my wife came. And Maurizio could he couldn't speak great English, so Jesus was kind of the translator. But just the way Maurizio was with my dad and my mum, and just making such an effort with them and like making a fuss over them, it meant so much to me, because I just knew he was making a fuss of my dad, because it was big for my dad, obviously, you know, meeting Maurizio and just asking him questions. And you know, I know there are managers out there that wouldn't have even turned up to that. They'd have made an excuse, especially not really speaking the language. So there was so many kind of things that happened, I think, on like on a human level, which was to a reason why we were so successful in a year and a half, and he was so successful at the football club, because he just spent time on building relationships, not just with me, but with, you know, go through every player that he worked under there, any member of staff, because they all would have been in his office and had an hour drinking tea or coffee or whatever, just chatting.
Do you think you're quite blessed with the managers you've worked under, because you would have gained, I think, quite a lot of different things from all of them?
Oh, I'm very, very lucky. I'm very lucky. I mean, I've arguably worked with two of the best managers, you know, in world football, with Jurgen and Maurizio, in my opinion. Also, not forgetting Brendan as well. You know, Gareth Southgate was brilliant as well. And it's great to see him still doing well with England at the moment. But yeah, I've been very, very fortunate to work with, like what you said, this, you know, especially two of the, you know, most spoken about managers, in probably being the best at what they do.
You have always had quite a tactical mind, and I actually know, in terms of game management at Liverpool, you were one of the driving forces in trying to, you know, make sure there was offensive protection and stop playing on adrenaline. Let's try to think through games more. Given the managers you've worked with, given the fact that you have quite a tactical mind, post-football, are you thinking that management, especially given how much you like working with youngsters and aiding their development and stuff, is that where your mind is heading eventually?
The truth is, I still don't know. I'm still not sure, but I'm, you know, going off. Listen, I think the last couple of years at Liverpool, I didn't play so much. I felt me kind of being a big impact in the training, being a big kind of personality around the young lads, kind of how we kind of created the culture that, you know, created the environment at Liverpool. That really kind of stimulated me and gave me another focus, because I wasn't playing as much, so I was training a lot and training hard. So I think that did really give me, as I said, another stimulation that you need as a footballer. You know, it's difficult for anyone who's not getting regular minutes, and that really did kind of help me and give me another focus. Whereas, you know, now I'm at Brighton, I'm playing a lot more. I'm feeling, you know, as fit as I've felt for a couple of years, simply because I'm playing regularly and I'm getting minutes. I don't feel like I'm ready to kind of, you know, think about that yet. I want to give every bit of attention to me right now, and that's playing. I don't want to kind of be thinking to myself, oh, you know, what do I want to be doing when I finish? Because, you know, I'll never get these 3-4 years back, and I want to make sure that I get every bit out of these 3-5 years what I've got left playing. So I can see where the questions come from, and you're not the only person that's asked me, because of my, you know, the last couple of years, I've shown an interest in helping develop young players. And even, you know, Brighton, I enjoy, or whatever, I'll try and help doesn't even have to be a young player, just help a fellow teammate. Like, you know, they can help me if they've got a bit of advice or they see something. But I really kind of want to focus on the playing football because I've not played regularly for what feels like a long time. I don't kind of want to waste any energy and Did you kind of understand what I'm saying there?
Yeah. No, I get you completely. In terms of football, I think we've seen throughout the coronavirus pandemic, and just I think in general, this is sort of a thing, which it really shouldn't be. But there's this misperception that because you guys earn very well, because you're living the dream, that you shouldn't be affected by stuff, you know? You've got an injury, so what? Get on with it. There's an almost robotic element to how people view footballers. You're not meant to have emotion. You're not meant to... You're just meant to turn up, train, play, perform at what people are expecting to be 9 out of 10, 10 out of 10 every week without the human elements of it, just because you're well compensated and all the fame and stuff that comes with it. So I wanted you to speak just on the other side of it, on how you are still human, you are still, you know, a dad, a husband, a son, and you have all those emotions and all those feelings, and you have dark days and you have difficulties still.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the simplest way I think I can explain it is that, you know, Mel, I'm sure you have shit days at work, don't you? You have days where you underperform. It might not be highlighted in the press, or you might read an article backing it, or you're like, do you know what, I could have spent a bit longer on that, or I shouldn't have put that in, or I should have quoted that. And it's the same with football players. You know, you have training sessions where you underperform, you have matches where you underperform, or you made a couple of wrong decisions and you get punished for it and you lose football matches. And the only difference is between, you know, you having a shit day at work and me having a bad day at work is, you know, we get scrutinized by, you know, not just fans, but media outlets or social medias. And it's, as I said, it's part and parcel of the industry. So many people love it. So many people are passionate about football teams and they have their teams that they support. It's, it is what it is. I don't think we're ever going to get in a perfect world where there's no, you know, there's no negativity on social medias, because everyone's always going to have opinions. So I don't think that kind of perfect world exists, but like what you said, we are humans. And I think it's important that people need to realize that we do have bad days at the office. We, you know, that will happen. You know, we don't want it to happen, but it does happen. We try for it not to happen. Believe me, we work day in, day out. And, you know, kind of being at Brighton as well, the past 3-4 months has taught me as well, is that, you know, how hard it is getting a Premier League win. I probably took that for granted, being at Liverpool, being lucky enough to, you know, the home record that we had, or we went unbeaten last year for however long. You know, it's getting a Premier League win is difficult. And it's as I say, it's a work in progress, and it's we're gonna have to work that little bit harder to get over the line and get points. But it's it's tough. You know, playing in the Premier League is tough, and people are gonna make mistakes. It's part and parcel of football, isn't it? Football's all about mistakes. It's how you react to them, I think.
Exactly that. And all of our recent guests on Between the Lines, Pochettino, Gary Lineker, Daniel Sturridge, have all actually mentioned how taxing it is to be an elite footballer. Like you say, Premier League wins are so hard to come by. You do everything, you condition yourself so well. You know, your recovery schedule is so planned out. Basically, your entire existence is geared to be able to perform at this elite level, and there probably isn't an appreciation or a full understanding at how much it takes to be a footballer in the Premier League.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's even, you could even probably double that if you're playing in Europe and a somewhat top four team, for example, because the amount of games you have is relentless. And I think, you know, we're all going through a phase at the minute where there's been an increase in injuries, and there's lots of debates happening about whether we should have, you know, have five subs in the Premier League, and players are the ones that just get, you know, go on, play another game in, you know, 3-4 days. Or, you know, I heard Ole Gunnar Solskjaer the other day, you know, they were in Turkey on the Wednesday, and then they played on the Saturday, didn't they, at Goodison Park first thing. And I agree with him. I don't understand why that needs to happen when it's easy enough for it not to happen. You know, just give them the extra day, put it on TV the next day, because the players are the ones that suffer. You know, they're the ones that feels like just getting rolled out every 3-4 days, especially during this pandemic. Like what you said, brings the added pressures. I don't think it's fair. You know, but who am I to say that? It's another talking point, isn't it? But as I said, we have seen an increase in injuries, and I don't think there's no coincidence that it's because the amount of games that are being played. Simple as that. Going back to what we're saying, I mean, normal people, as in referring to the fact that I trained in Brighton today. I came back to Bournemouth from Brighton, which is work. You know, I went, picked the kids up from school, came back from school. Wife made us dinner. Went upstairs, bathed the kids. Read with both the kids in bed, got the kids to sleep, and then I'm down here doing the interview, got the footy on in front of me. It'll be 10:30, 11, I'll go to sleep, get up tomorrow, we've got tomorrow off, and drop the kids at school, come home. I'll, luckily enough to, you know, I've got a day off, so I'll go on a couple of walks with the dog, because obviously at the moment there's not much else people can do, you know what I mean? So obviously lots of people are walking. I see that as a pretty normal enough day. I mean, do you agree or not? I mean, I'm interested to see what you think.
No, I definitely think it's normal enough. And I love the fact that you're just like, pretty much like my dad and stuff. When we wanted a dog, we just got it, and he had to live with yeah. it. He had to just deal with the fact that we got a dog. So even if you're a footballer, it still happens.
Yeah, it still happens. Yeah, I mean, as I say, I'm away quite a bit at the moment, a lot of the time in Brighton. So the dog's great company for my wife and kids. But you know, I'm the one that's down here with the dog, giving it, making sure it goes out to the toilet its last time before the night. And yeah, I seem to have all them kind of jobs, really, which I didn't sign up to. But
Is it fully house trained yet, or is there still accidents happening?
Miles off being fully house trained, but it's step by step, I suppose.
We've started from the top, reflecting on your time at the academy, and I just wonder now, you know, given your status in the game, given the fact that you're seen as a veteran, which I know is quite odd to think of, how do you assess your career as a whole?
I kind of look at my career, and I look at it, obviously it was built at Southampton, and obviously made the jump to go to Liverpool and had a 6-year stretch there. It was amazing. It was full of so many ups, even more downs, dark moments. And now I've like come out of that. I say like come out of that. I think it's because Liverpool as a football club is so intense. It takes up, you know, every minute, every second of your day, just because I think the stature of the club, what it, you know, its history, the demands to win silverware, the demands to perform, and kind of now coming out of that, it almost feels like I can, you know, breathe again a little bit. In a way, that's not meaning it in a bad way, and that I didn't enjoy it because I absolutely loved it. It's just different to being at Brighton. It's different to being at Southampton, almost just feel. I kind of compare how I'm feeling now a little bit more to how I was feeling when I was probably at Southampton. You know, being at a similar size club, and I'm enjoying it, you know. I was never ever in any doubt that I made the wrong decision. I always knew it was the right decision, and it's proving right. I do feel, yeah. Do you know what I mean when I say it feels like I can breathe a bit more? Not literally, but you know, I'm finished training most days at 1 o'clock, and you know, I've got the rest of the day to maybe do something with the kids or play some golf. It's just less intense. It's less intense in a whole package. Less games, not in Europe, not playing international football. So it's less intense. Doesn't mean that don't care as much, don't want to do my job as professionally enough, because that isn't the case, and you'll understand that. You know, there might be people out there that think differently because I'm saying that, but it's not. It's just different.
No, I get you. Yeah, it is relentless when you're at Liverpool. And I actually saw a post recently that said we need to stop glorifying overworking, and we need to stop glorifying not taking a rest, not focusing on, you know, giving yourself some me time or allowing yourself to spend moments with friends and family because you are so geared to your career. So it makes a lot of sense what you're saying. And you've got more time on your hands now to get that puppy house trained properly.
I think, but when you're playing for a top club, when you say a top club or a club in Europe, it's hard to find that time. Do you know what I mean? It's taken out of your hands because of the relentless schedule you've got. And that's, you know, it may be a sacrifice for some. It may just be normality to others. But I think once, because I've lived it before Liverpool and now I've come and I'm living it again after, you kind of, you know, kind of make sure you appreciate just both sides of it, I suppose. And, you know, it also makes you realise that it is demanding playing for Liverpool, you know, seeing like what Hendo's done for that football club and being the captain and the sacrifices he makes of his time, and it's full on. And that's why, you know, huge respect to, you know, everyone that plays for them teams that are in Europe and that are playing international football. I mean, just watching Ronaldo again now playing for Portugal, I mean, you know, with the respect that I've got for him, just churns out game after game, whether it's for club or whether it's for Portugal. I mean, it's amazing that he's been doing this for 15 years. Relentless.
Thank you to Adam for being so illuminating on so many aspects beneath the surface of becoming a professional footballer and what's required to stay at an elite level. Cheers to you for listening in, and I hope you've gleaned a lot from this episode. If you need tips on house training a new puppy, holler at me. And feel free to share any feedback over these shows, plus shout with who you'd like to hear from as a guest. Between the Lines is a Stakhanov production, written and narrated by me, Melissa Reddy. Our producer is Charlie Morgan. Our assistant producer is Natalie Wilson. The executive producers are John Teague and Luke Aaron Moore. Sound design and mixing is by Tom Wally. All music comes courtesy of Epidemic Sound. Thanks for listening. Tune in next time.
This was a Stakhanov production and part of the Acast Creative Network.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit. And he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And on my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.